Sometimes I think you can be in the infinite inning all your life. I'd be surprised if all of us hadn't encountered someone whose sole role in your story, from a plot point of view, I mean, was to be an antagonist. You might have run into them as part of your family, or more likely at work or in school, it doesn't matter. The commonality isn't setting, but character. That, for whatever reason, they were just such a ball of unremitting hostility that, even if they were in some other sense valuable, say that they were good at their job, they made you and everyone around them miserable. There are figures in sports like that. Sometimes when you see a trade or a release that doesn't otherwise make sense, it's because someone in the organization said to themselves, if I have to coexist with this person for one more day, I don't care if it costs me the World Series, I am not putting up with it. In the early 1990s, at a point before I had become a professional writer, I had a brief conversation with the then general manager of the New York Giants, and they had just released a player, a free safety as I recall, who was still kind of productive, maybe he wasn't a star, but had had a good season for them, and they just cut him for some reason. I got the chance, in private, to ask why. And the off-the-record answer, after I carefully explained that I was not a journalist yet, was basically that he was an ass, and that they just didn't want to deal with him anymore. And it's notable to me that that player was never signed by anybody else. He had essentially worn out his welcome. Almost every trade of Rogers Hornsby was like that. He might hit 380 with 40 home runs for you, but after a certain amount of time, people couldn't deal with him. And the deal that sent him away from the Cardinals was in part because he was supposedly welching on gambling debts around town. But the real clincher was that his mother passed away during the 1926 World Series, and he wouldn't go to the funeral. Now, that was his choice to put baseball first, and maybe some people would approve of that, but the owner was disgusted. He just thought, this guy won't honor his own mom? I don't want to ever look at his face again. And he got dealt off to the New York Giants. And not for an equal return, because by definition, you can't get an equal return for Rogers Hornsby. At least, you can't get an equal return for the back of his baseball card. But the whole point of the trade was that as a person, he was lower than the lowest utility infielder. Unfortunately, most of us are not general managers or managers, and we don't have the ability to just disappear our antagonists that way. I had a bizarre experience in high school I've talked about in other places a few times, and if you've heard me tell this story before, I apologize, but it seems to fit this. One quarter, I was given a gym locker in an obscure corner of the locker room, and it was just me and this other guy who was more or less a stranger to me. He was part of my class, but not somebody I ever encountered. I went to a fairly large high school, and so you could have somebody in your class and not know them at all, never have a class with them. And this guy who, as I said, I had no relationship with, had never exchanged a word with, hated me. Or I don't know if it was even me. I just know that standard practice for us as kids in the gym locker room was you went in, you change your clothes as quickly as possible from your civilian garb to your exercise clothing, and then you went out and then you did the thing in reverse after the fact. And you had to do it that way because even if teenage modesty didn't compel you to do so, the teachers would yell at you to get out of the locker room and onto the field if you didn't do it in a hurry. But this guy, he dragged it out and he was angry about it. And he was angry at me about it, and I don't exactly know why. He would strip down to his white jockey shorts and then say, "Hey," and I'd look up. And he'd say, "What are you looking at? Don't look at me. You want this?" I don't know if he thought I was gay and he disliked that. I wasn't and had never given anybody any indication to think that I was. And day after day he would do this, strip down, hang out more or less naked, and yell at me. And then he added a twist to it. He would produce a huge roll of money. I don't know what the denominations were, but he would stand there and start counting out bills and say, "You want this? You want this?" Years later, somebody suggested to me that maybe it was an anti-Semitic thing, that he was taunting me with money because I was Jewish. I really don't know. The thing is, I did nothing to provoke it. I did nothing to encourage its continuance. I just did my best to ignore it, but it was somehow upsetting. And I'm not a religious person, but I would say, God, I'm 16 years old. My girlfriend's parents don't like me and try to thwart every arrangement we make to date. I'm behind in all my classes and not doing well. My father is on my case 24/7 about my grades. I am miserable, and I need a little sunlight in my life. And you give me this? The naked guy with the roll of money? I'm glad to know you have a sense of humor, but please stop. But it didn't, and all I could do was just wait it out. There was a player in the early Negro Leagues named John Beckwith. He was called the Black Bomber. He was a third baseman and shortstop despite being built something like Albert Bell. And the comparison to Albert Bell is kind of pointed because there were some similarities in terms of coexisting with John Beckwith. He was so good that he was able to turn pro at 17, and he lasted until he was about 35, and he might have lasted longer had he not been so difficult. He was both angry and inebriated in different proportions pretty much all the time. If you read descriptions of his play, he was a great ball player. He seemed to hit 350 to 400 annually despite the fact that he was a deadpool hitter and they would stack the left side of the infield against him. And there are numerous accounts of him blasting balls out of major league ballparks in ways that the white major leaguers didn't do at the time. Out of Crosley Field, and even more impressively, out of Griffith Stadium in Washington, where almost nobody hit home runs. But as I said, he was hostile, bordering on violent, and he sometimes crossed that border. There was one occasion that he had to jump from Baltimore to Harrisburg, because he had gotten into a scuffle with an umpire, and by scuffle, I mean put him in the hospital, and he had to leave town before an arrest warrant could be served. Let me just give you this description from the Biographical Encyclopedia of the Negro Baseball Leagues by James Riley, which is a great book if you don't have it. The numbers he accumulated during his career are impressive, but unfortunately, his contributions to a team with his natural ability were offset by negative intangibles. Beckwith was moody, brooding, hot-tempered, and quick to fight, combined with a severe drinking problem and an often lazy, unconcerned attitude about playing. His character deficiencies often negated his performance value. Sometimes he would play in an inebriated condition or exhibit meanness on the field. On one occasion, when Beckwith's error cost a game, pitcher Bill Holland tossed his glove in disgust and, in the clubhouse after the game, Beckwith responded by knocking the pitcher unconscious. Not mentioned here is that Beckwith had about a half foot of height and 50 pounds on the pitcher. After his baseball career, he actually became a policeman in New York, but that didn't take, and he wound up in prostitution, gambling, and other illicit activities and died young. But that's not the point. The point is that after 1923, when he was 23 years old, he never spent more than two seasons in any one place, despite the fact that, if the anecdotes are to be believed, he was routinely socking the ball 450 feet. I've talked to so many friends on different occasions who said my job would be perfect if only Boris wasn't there. I've had that experience myself with some guys who were great writers but went out of their way to make everyone else on the staff dread coming to work in the morning. And the question was always, is the number of hits that Boris gets worth living with Boris? And I really wish that we had the power in our own lives to trade those people, to DFA them, to outright release them, to put them on unconditional waivers. Because life is too short to put up with a Rogers Hornsby or a John Beckwith, no matter how many home runs they hit. Even the World Series isn't worth that. If your greatest triumph is achieved at the cost of coexisting with a human monster for a year, then how satisfying will the memory of that achievement be? I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Chief asks if you'd like to come along on a little ocean voyage, and you think, sure, vacation. Little do you know that it's a trip of thousands of miles to the Crimean resort of Yalta, where the chief will be negotiating the future of the post-war world with Joseph Stalin and Winston Churchill. Now it's 10 years later, and you're being accused of helping to sell out U.S. interests to the Russians. Barely beating it out the door ahead of a subpoena from UEC, you stash your papers in a hollow pumpkin and hide out here in a little unheated cabin known as Episode 18. Next time, you'll take your vacation at Pismo Beach. If you're rejoining us or coming along for the first time, welcome. I thank you. Those of you who have been along for the ride to this point, I owe you something of an apology because this episode is a couple of days late. The reasons for that are my own infirmity. I think Yalta came to mind because when FDR came back, he gave his report to Congress sitting down, and he asked them to forgive his unusual posture, but that it was easier for him not to have to stand and carry 20 pounds of steel on each leg. If you go to the FDR Library in Hyde Park, New York, they actually let you indulge in a little simulation where you can try to lift the amount of weight that FDR had to have on each leg. You can feel exactly what the braces must have felt like to wear. By that point, in 1945, he was a dying man, and his heart just couldn't sustain that kind of additional stress. Whereas President Roosevelt had to sit down, I'm doing this recording standing up. I can't sit. My back, and this is a gift of many years of being hunched over baseball prospectus annuals, as well as other factors, some my fault, some that just happen, has not worked well, and I seem to have done something to aggravate it, possibly being hunched over this microphone. I don't know. There's a great story in the life of George Washington in that just after the end of the Revolutionary War, his officers were going to lead a revolutionary march of their own on Congress because Congress hadn't bothered to pay anybody. Everything repeats, you see, and the more Congress changes, the more Congress stays the same. That would have been the end of the American experiment right then. We would have gone the way so many banana republics do, with a military coup, a takeover. Washington crashed the meeting of these soldiers and assured them that he had been in touch with Congress and they were going to be taken care of. And he said, I have a letter from a congressman here. And he reached into his pocket to produce the letter and he took it out and he sort of squinted at it. And then he put it down and again reached into his pocket and pulled out some glasses, and no one had really seen him in glasses. And he said, you'll forgive me for putting these on, but I have grown not only gray, but also nearly blind in the service of my country. All the assembled troops went, aw, how can we overthrow Congress when the general is such a touching and pathetic figure? And the coup fell apart. It's an example of an often unremarked upon theatricality on Washington's part, but I prefer not to think of it as theatricality. I think it was a sincere gesture. He wasn't calculating in that way. In any case, like Washington, I have grown gray and almost blind in the service of baseball, and now I have a severe stabbing pain when I sit down. So I'm about a week out from seeing an orthopedist, and in the meantime, it's hard for me to work on the show for a sustained length of time. Pretty much everything is kind of challenging right now, including sleeping, which is another problem because of 9 of the official 11 sleeping positions. I just made that number up, but let's go with it. 9 of the official 11 sleeping positions. 10 of them cause me pain when I attempt them, so I wake up every few minutes. This is no reflection on today's co-pilot, Jesse Spector, but I did have to sit for more than an hour talking to Jesse, and it was uncomfortable. And in the conversation that follows, you'll hear us touch on a number of issues as regards the current season, and then some kind of meta ones about recognizing the season's best team, whether they win the World Series or not, the injuries to Matt Bush and Joey Gallo in Texas, and some of the usual ruminations about the Mets' injury situation. And one benefit of our delay, if you can call it that, is that as I was editing this episode, Michael Conforto tore his own arm out of the socket on a swing. So our discussion of whether the Mets are particularly bad at preventing injuries or are just snake-bitten seems to have taken on an additional salience. In any case, I don't think you'll hear me being distracted by the pain, because that's a subtle thing, but each time that I responded to Jesse, when I was saying, yes, the Mets, what I really wanted to say was, mommy. So I appreciate your patience and just know that I've put myself in this position because whereas it might be easy for me to obtain some heavy-duty painkillers prior to my going to see these specialists to see what I can do about this situation, I just don't want to be that guy on the commercial. You see me with my notebook and pen and I look up at the camera and say, hi, you wouldn't think a fella in my line could suffer a workplace injury, but I sure did, and now I have opioid-induced constipation. I can't think of very many things worse than becoming a spokesman for opioid-induced constipation. And so I'm suffering, and we're running a little behind, and for the third time I'll just say, my bad, my back, I'm sorry. There are some other stories I want to tell you. One in particular I've been saving up for about 3 weeks, but I've taken a lot of time and I'm tempted to leave it at one more Casey Stengel quote. You know, in 1960, he was suffering from some chest pains, which isn't totally surprising because he was 70 years old managing a Major League Baseball team, which is kind of stressful, and there was almost no time that he was not drinking or smoking. In fact, he pointed out that he did stop smoking sometimes when he was asleep, otherwise not so much. When he got back from the doctors, he said, they examined all my organs. Some of them are quite remarkable and others are not so good. A lot of museums are bidding for them. But I'm not going to leave it there, tempting as that is, because that reminds me of a pitcher of his who also suffered a back injury, Allie Reynolds. Reynolds was this tremendously versatile pitcher who was in the major leagues from 1942 to 1954. He was fractionally a Native American with Creek ancestry, but everybody just thought of him as a Native American. His teammates on the Yankees called him Super Chief. That was half a reference to his ancestry and half a reference to the famous Chicago to Los Angeles train on the Santa Fe Railroad that ran at that time. And that one wasn't too bad. He was also called the Vanishing Indian because he had a reputation for blowing games late and close and needing a reliever. This was at a time when throwing complete games was a manhood issue for pitchers, and that one wasn't so cool. I don't think he liked either of them. Regardless of that, he was actually a very good starter, and he was particularly effective when he got traded to the Yankees in 1946 for Joe Gordon, one of these rare trades of a great player for a great player that worked out for everybody. Starting about 1950, Casey Stengel used him as 75% a starter and 25% a closer. So, for example, in 1951, when he went 17-5 with two no-hitters that year and a league-leading 7 shutouts, he also finished 11 games and saved 6. The next year, he went 20-8, led the league in shutouts again, and also finished 6 games and saved all 6. Here's one of my favorite things about him. His first no-hitter in 51, again, he pitched 2, was against his old team in Cleveland, and it ended when he struck out Bobby Avila. This is a great thing about America and about the American game, baseball. A pitcher who identified as a Native American could face a 300 hitter who was born in Veracruz, Mexico, with a no-hitter on the line. That's baseball in a nutshell. It's pure meritocracy. His second no-hitter was kind of a cool story, too. It was against the Red Sox late that same season, and it clinched the pennant for the Yankees. But the notable thing about it was that he had gotten through 8 2/3 innings without allowing a hit, and that brought up Ted Williams. And Williams had a good handle on Reynolds. He had a good handle on everybody. But he saw Reynolds particularly well, hitting .368 against him lifetime in 96 plate appearances. There are 6 home runs in there, and there are also 28 walks, because Reynolds just got bored of pitching to him and decided to walk him every time. He was the last guy you'd want to see up there. But Reynolds got him, sort of. Williams popped a high foul behind home plate, and Yogi Berra went back for it, but he stumbled and dropped the ball. Reynolds took it coolly, said, "Don't worry, Yogi, we'll get him again." The guy who was really ticked was Williams, because he didn't want to be in the position of being a villain a second time. He was relieved, in a way, to have made an out. They reset. Reynolds throws the same pitch. Williams pops it up in the same spot. This time Yogi makes the play, and 2/3 of everybody go to the Hall of Fame. Not Reynolds, and maybe he never would have made it, but one reason why. 2 seasons later, in 1953, the Yankees are being bussed away from Shibe Park, having lost a game to the A's, and they're heading for the 30th Street Station in Pennsylvania, which is still in use for the train ride back to New York. And the bus driver of the charter that was taking them from the ballpark to the station is getting in close, and the players see the station is coming up. So as people do on all kinds of commuter vehicles now, when they see that the station is coming into view, they start getting up and collecting their things. In this case, it was the New York Yankees. They all rise up and they're in the aisles and they're pulling their suitcases and stuff. What they didn't realize is that the driver had screwed up and he had headed the bus for an underpass through which the bus could not fit because it was too tall. He hits it. The top of the bus is sheared off, the front collapses, and all these players who are standing up go flying, literally in some cases, the length of the bus. In the newspaper reports at the time, it was mostly said the backup catcher, Charlie Silvera, had some damage to his ribs, as did the pitching coach, Jim Turner. The trainer was hit by a falling suitcase and was cut. Stengel banged his head in some way, and he joked it off, saying he had a headache, but my head hasn't been working right for 2 weeks anyway, so it didn't matter. But it wasn't released to the papers at the time that Reynolds had slammed his back badly on the seat behind him, and it never was the same. I don't know what the specific diagnosis was, but it wasn't something that was fixable at that time in the 1950s. He couldn't pitch as often anymore. He couldn't pitch as well. He lacked the command that he had previously had. And although he never did get bombed, he was forced to retire in 1954 at the age of 37. He was a man who didn't fool himself, and he said, "Because of my back, I couldn't condition. And if I couldn't condition, I knew I couldn't last as a pitcher." So he got out of baseball, and he went into the oil business, and he did very well. He also sued the bus company for negligence and won an out-of-court settlement. But it's scary in a way how you can go in a 2-year period from leading the American League in ERA, as he did in 1952, 2.06, to being forced into retirement, even though he hadn't really lost anything. And that's just my way of saying, I hope I'm not like Allie Reynolds and I can get back to doing this on a timely basis in the near future, because damned if I know anything about the oil business. One other note on Reynolds. The book The Men of Autumn by Dom Forker is a series of interviews with many of the Yankees from that period. A whole lot of them are no longer around. And Reynolds says this, "Of course, there were some days when you were out there when you didn't want to be. Some days it was your day in the barrel. That's when Casey didn't have any fresh arms. Regardless what happened, you were in for the full time. Once against Boston, I was out on the mound for 3.5 hours. I gave up 17 hits and 17 runs. A reporter said to me after the game, 'That killed your ERA this year.' 'Hell, it ruined it for my whole career,' I said. But that's the way they operated. If it was your turn to take a beating, you took it." Thanks to Baseball Reference, I now know that that game never happened. At no time during the entire length of Reynolds' career, whether he was pitching with the Yankees or pitching with the Indians at the beginning of the 1940s, did a starting pitcher allow that many runs in a game to the Boston Red Sox. The most that Reynolds allowed to the Red Sox was 8 runs in 8 innings on July 2nd, 1950. And guess what? The Yankees won that game 15-9. He got the win. It's never surprising when players inflate their achievements when reminiscing with writers, but when they inflate their defeats, that's something else altogether. And on that literally sore note, I'll be back with Jesse Spector in just a moment. I feel a thrill right down to my knees, and it's because it's time once again to welcome Jesse Spector back to the program. How are you, Jesse?
I'm nervous because I saw Sam Miller was listening to this and praised it on the internet. And Sam is a guy who I don't think I've ever met. And every time I read him, I am duly impressed by what he does. His latest thing on the longest play of all time in the Rhode Island High School Championship was, you know, his typical amazing kind of work. And I saw that tweet and I immediately quote tweeted it saying, temper your enthusiasm because I'll be on this week. And here I am. So Sam,
I completely missed that. If he said that,
said he really loved it.
I will have to go back and check. He is someone who, assuming we're talking about the same Sam Miller, who followed me after the Ben Lindbergh interregnum. He followed me as BP editor in chief, and we never talked. You'd think there'd be like an alumni meeting or some kind of like secret fraternity you get to be part of, but you don't.
I have no idea. I just know that he's one of those people that I can't hope to, you know, approach that level, and it's. It's frustrating because there's a few people, you know, in our business who are like that, where it's like, yeah, we operate on kind of the same wavelength, but they just have an ability to put things together in a way that I can't, and I'm always impressed by it, and always just have a low opinion of myself on this kind of thing, but always just dazzled by how much better they are than and Sam's one of them. For sure.
I feel the same way. He's awesome. And Jesse, I think I talk about that kind of feeling of insecurity or inauthenticity or self-doubt, whatever it is, almost every week on this program. Because if you're a writer, I mean, this is true in everything, right? They always tell you there's always someone smarter than you. There's always somebody better looking. There's always someone better at whatever it is, run faster, jump higher, whatever. But I feel like we're confronted with it so often when you are a professional writer, because there are people who, like, you put together is a great way of putting it, that can sequence words in a certain way, can come up with jokes that are funnier. And I think both of us, like, each of us has a certain way of doing things, and we're probably proud of what we're doing within that sphere. But all the time you look at somebody and it's like you feel like you're a finger painter standing next to Picasso.
Yeah, and maybe your finger paintings look really cool, but you still feel like I'm finger painting here. To be your own biggest critic is something that I think that is certainly the case for me, and I feel like we've talked a few times over time, and I think that's something that may be the case for you as well. And it's a tough thing to get out of the way of, to just let your stuff work. I have a habit of, you know, somebody tells me that they like something I did, I'm like, really?
Right.
Okay, thank you. That's strange that was the one that you liked.
Right.
Whatever, yeah. And then, like, the stuff that I actually do that I like is stuff that nobody ever seems to connect with, which is, another...
Yes.
It's a difficult It's a tough, tough professional existence that way, and something that I didn't really anticipate when getting into it, that was, you know, something that I would feel that way about my own work, because there was a time, certainly as a younger writer, when I felt good about most of the things that I did, and most of it was pretty bad, going back and looking at it. Like, I'm thinking, like, you know, as a college newspaper writer, and I've gone back and looked at some of that stuff, and it is abysmal.
No, never do that.
Yeah. But it's like, I thought at the time that stuff was good, and now, like, maybe I do actually do some good work, but I think that the vast majority of what I do, and, you know, if any of my current employers are out there listening to this, it's all great. I think it's all garbage. Like, 95% of what I do, I walk away from it, and I was like, boy, what was I even doing with that? Like, maybe there was an inkling of a good idea there, but it just turned into, I don't know. I leave the ballpark most nights when I write at a game. I leave the ballpark and just sort of sit kicking myself on the subway home, thinking of the different ways that I could have done things and what I could have written differently, how I could have ordered things differently, how I could have just, you know, done anything better. And then that's part of the reason it takes me a while to fall asleep when I get home.
I'm right with you. And especially the part about stuff that you think is really good just vanishes without a trace. It just disappears beneath the surface of the ocean. Like, and the stuff that you just, and look, I think we both have enough professional pride that we wouldn't characterize anything we do as phoned in, but stuff that is basic is just, you know, your kind of standard column, because for whatever reason, either the news cycle or inspiration or whatever, just demanded that you do this kind of fairly rote analysis without a whole lot of flourish. And it's that stuff that tends to click more often. And I don't know if that says more about the audience or about us or the lack of connection between the two, but it can be frustrating.
I don't think at least we're alone in that. I think that, you know, it's the same thing of, you think of all the movie directors out there, and I'm certainly not putting myself on that level, but yeah, the director who makes the box office popcorn film to bankroll the passion piece. It's not that different, and I think it's even been put to me in those terms when I was, you know, a full-time employee, that, you know, the clicky stuff is what we do so that we can do the stuff that we really want to do. I don't know that it always necessarily adds up that way. At least that's the theory.
Especially because when you do, you won't believe what this squirrel did next. It can be kind of soul-killing.
I'm interested in what squirrels do next. Squirrel pops up on my fire escape. I'm watching that thing. What's it going to do? Is it going to eat some of the bird seed out of the bird feeder that's, you know, only been a squirrel feeder? Or is it going to just jump around and try to climb up to the roof? What's going to happen there? It's interesting. I've taken us way off the track already.
No, that's where this podcast lives, I think. Let me change from this sort of writer's existential crisis and ennui to a more positive development, because we do have some good Jesse news. You said this online earlier today that you're going to be writing for the Jersey Devils for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's breaking news. A 1-year deal with the New Jersey Devils. It's a funny thing because I did not like the New Jersey Devils as a youth, and that's one of those. I may have talked about this. I've certainly talked about it elsewhere. I don't know if I've talked about it here. Of, you know, just what becoming a professional writer does for you. Of, you know, the time that I spent covering Devils games when I was a full-time hockey writer, and being like I didn't like I was a Rangers fan. I didn't like the Devils. I, you know, couldn't stand Martin Brodeur in particular because he was so good and he beat my team all the time. Then I become a writer and I talk to that guy and spend time with, you know, around that locker room during a big playoff run for them, and and it's the same thing that I kind of went through with the Red Sox, you know, earlier in my career, where they were one of my favorite, and during the, you know, the Cowboy Up Idiots era, they were one of my favorite teams when they would come to visit Yankee Stadium, and I would go into the locker room and talk with those guys, and they were all super open and approachable, and really the complete opposite of this current Red Sox team, where it is tense in that Red Sox room now. It's a bizarre thing. And centered around David Price, who up until joining the Red Sox was a cool guy to talk to and, like, friendly and a fascinating dude, because he could remember what pitch he threw in an at-bat to a specific batter 5 years ago. Like, he's that dialed into what he does, and it's amazing. And that's no longer a thing. So, yeah, I'm writing for the Devils now once a week during the season, and we'll see how that goes, because it should be a lot of fun. Glad to be back doing hockey in addition to baseball.
I don't know that much about hockey. I'm the most casual of casual fans. What I do know is I have almost a sentimental feeling about the 1982 season, because that's when the Devils showed up here, and they were horrible. They were 17-49 with 14 ties that year, and they didn't have a winning season for forever, depending on how you count it. And I don't know. If it were me, I would count it as more wins than losses and ties, but I noticed that they don't count the tie. I must sound like a complete naif to anybody who actually knows hockey, that, you know, they don't count the ties in the one loss percentage, at least it seems like. But to me, you would add the ties to the losses, and that would determine whether you had more wins than other stuff. But if you do it that way, the way I'm saying, they didn't actually have a winning season for 10 years. But
yeah, they absolutely don't do it that way. And in fact, now that ties are out, they just count it as, it's the stupidest thing in the world, as if you're over hockey 500, because it's wins, losses, and then overtime shootout losses, which are their own category, and you get a point for that, just like you used to with ties. So you just have to have more wins than losses to be considered over 500, and, you know, in a 30, now 31 team league, like 22 or 23 teams will be over, quote-unquote, 500 in a season. It's ludicrous and stupid, and nobody should think about it that way. The way that you think about it, I'm not so sure if it's correct when it comes to ties, because a tie is, you know, a half-win, half-loss kind of situation. That at least makes sense, that you have more wins than losses, you're over 500, because the rest are ties, and they shouldn't count in that regard. When the third column is a form of loss, it's mind-blowingly stupid that that's the way that they count it up. So you go on thinking about it the way that you think about it, because you are correct.
Well, that must be a kind of a larger scale version of what baseball has done with its expanded playoffs. And I mean, I think it's somewhat reasonable. Like, when it first happened, I felt kind of like a disgruntled purist. But now I think you've got 30 teams. You have to compete with lots of other forms of entertainment to keep people's interest. So it does, I think, make sense to expand the playoffs from either where it was pre-divisions, which was just two teams go to the World Series, that's it, everybody else goes home, to the four that we had for a long time. So it doesn't seem unreasonable to me. But maybe with hockey, I mean, if you're saying two-thirds of the teams become playoff eligible or something, I guess you really do want to keep people involved and psyched for their team. But don't a lot of the teams that are kind of gerrymandered into the playoffs that way just instantly disappear?
Sort of, not really. It's a 16-team playoff, the way that they have done it now, and there's a lot of real stupid about it now that a lot of people have a lot of complaints about it, is the way they do it is top three in each division make it. And I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, okay, because it's, as somebody who's kind of coming at it fresh. So you have four divisions.
Okay.
Two conferences, two divisions each. So top three in each division make it. And then the remaining spots are two wild cards. The top wild card will be a fourth place team from some division, and will play the division winner with the worst record. And the second wild card will be either a fourth place team or a fifth place team, and from a division, and will play the division winner with the best record and go into that division's playoffs. So, for instance, this year, the Rangers were the first wild card, and they went into the playoff. They went into the Atlantic Division playoffs, even though they're a Metropolitan Division team. They played the Montreal Canadiens in the first round and beat them, and then played the Ottawa Senators and lost. Meanwhile, the Penguins and Capitals, who were the two best teams in the league, because it's a division-based playoff system, wind up meeting each other in the second round of the playoffs, as the Penguins are on their way to the Stanley Cup. So they faced the toughest of their opponents by the standings mm-hmm. in the second round.
As opposed to a later round.
Yes. That caused a lot of consternation in the hockey world, as you might imagine.
So, right. So they had a higher bar, essentially, mm-hmm. than another team. I'm now cheating and looking at the standings. Washington finished ahead of the Penguins. So at what point would the Penguins face Washington?
They face them in the what would be the Metropolitan Division Finals. They Pittsburgh beat Columbus in the first round. That was the 2-3 matchup. Washington was the President's Trophy winner, best team in the league, and they beat whoever the other wild card was. I can't even remember. Oh, Toronto. That's the other silly thing, is that this year, four teams made it from each division in the East. The fourth place team from the Metropolitan went into the Atlantic playoffs, and the fourth place team from the Atlantic went into the Metropolitan playoffs, because that's how the wild card standings worked out.
And that's how Gregor Mendel discovered that pea plants, if you crossbreed them, carry their genes from one to the other. It is a bit confusing and baroque for somebody who is coming at it from the outside. It seems to me that if you want the regular season to have meaning, and we don't necessarily do this in baseball either with all the interleague play and stuff like that, is you want to have the best teams rewarded for having the best performance. So you set them up with patsies as much as you possibly can in a playoff situation until they move on.
And at least in hockey, they have a trophy for the, it's a trophy that is horribly devalued by everybody and nobody likes to talk. I like the fact that the President's Trophy exists, because for 6 months you're playing a season that then half the teams are going to make it into this playoff tournament for what? And it's the same in basketball. You know, half the teams in the league make it, and quite often it doesn't really matter in the NBA, because the best team in the regular season often is the team that winds up winning it all anyway, just because that's the way that basketball is. It bothers me so much in baseball too, and really more in baseball than in any other sport, that you play this whole 162 game season for 6 months, and then if the Dodgers don't win the World Series this year, they'll be looked at as chumps, just like the 2001 Mariners. Why? This is baseball. Like, no team has ever lost 4 out of 6 games, or 3 out of 5, or whatever. It's mind-boggling to me that you play for 6 months, and then you have one kind of lousy week against a good team where a couple of bounces don't go your way, and you stunk. I know that, you know, you're ultimately judged on championships, but man, we should have a little more respect for the 162.
No, I love that idea. I love the idea of having a best team trophy, and a great example of that is the 2001 Seattle Mariners, who won 116 games and then went out in the second round. They got through the division round and went to
They lost to the Yankees in the ALCS.
Right. And that was one of the all-time great teams, right? The 54 Indians with their 111 mm-hmm. wins, they got swept out of the World Series by a 97-win Giants team. And that was considered a great upset. And it was a great upset, maybe. Again, the schedules aren't the same, so you don't know, particularly when you're talking about teams back then in opposite leagues. But as I said, even now, not everybody has the same strength of schedule. That's why sometimes I get very frustrated with the NFL. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to get frustrated with the NFL, but the fact that you don't know really if one team's 12-4 is the same as another team's 12-4 is the same as another team's 8-8 because of the unevenness of the schedule. So yeah, I agree with you completely. There is in no way that the Dodgers season would be a failure if they got wiped off the map in the first round of the playoffs. It would just be a thing that happened. And I think part of that, and this is something people used to say about the Braves during the Bobby Cox years, where they only won, what, the one World Series, mm-hmm. is that there is a difference between a team that is built for the 162 game long haul and has the depth to be consistent in that period. And then maybe there's another kind of team that can just kind of get it up for 5 or 7 games and win in that situation, and they're not necessarily the same thing.
I mean, look at how Cleveland was built last year. I don't think that by any stretch of the imagination they were the best team in the American League, were they?
The starting rotation for much of the season until the injury started eating them, they were hitting on all cylinders, certainly.
Yeah, and Carrasco and Salazar both got hurt, and that does hurt them. But I think that you can look back at last season and Boston, to me, was a better team than them. Toronto was probably a better team than they were as well. Texas, I was more impressed by, and having, you know, Hamels and Darvish. So, to me, going in to playoffs, I looked at Cleveland as like the fourth best team in the American League. But, and this is, you know, being built for October, when they had Miller and Allen and Shaw able to do what they were able to do, especially the way that Terry Francona used Andrew Miller right up until game five of the World Series, when suddenly they forgot how they got there. And they still wind up being, you know, almost the world champions, but they were probably, and I didn't look at it appropriately when I was making my pre-playoff predictions last year, certainly, but, you know, looking back, the way they were built to win in October. And it is a different game because of the lack of the off days. And there have been people lately saying, well, you should, you know, maybe think about getting rid of some of the off days in the playoffs. Yeah, that's a terrible idea. Just the logistics of getting everybody around from city to city. And also, I want to see these guys at their best. Give them the off days. For one thing, the weather in October throughout North America begins to change. And unless you're dealing with teams that are in dome stadia or out in California, you're probably looking at a situation where you're going to want those days at some point, because there's going to be some weather and, you know, you may need it, and you don't want to futz up the entire rest of your playoff schedule. But beyond that, let's just have it so that, you know, these guys have played 6 months. They need some time in between, and maybe not the full boat of rest that maybe did in the Mets a couple of years ago. And certainly I think back to the 07 Rockies and the weight that they had between blowing through the National League playoffs and then coming to meet the Red Sox in the World Series, who handled them with a ridiculous amount of ease. I think that long layoff can hurt. You know, didn't wind up hurting the Cubs as much last year.
It strikes me that that's a double-edged sword, too, because I was flashing back to the, not that I'm so old that I remember this firsthand, but in the 1975 World Series, Louis Tiant got two starts in the first five games, and then there was a five-day rain delay, so they could bring him back a third time. And it doesn't matter who you are, and Tiant was just a mystifying pitcher, but it was a great team in the Cincinnati Reds who were facing the Red Sox that year, and they'd seen him three times. They had seen everything he had to offer, and that third time they were on him. So you can get to the point of overkill.
Yeah, it's a different game. You're playing the same team. You're not playing a three-game series or a four-game series. You're playing as many as seven. I don't think that there's a problem with adding in off days when it's a different animal. You play games differently in October, you know, as it is. Like, if you're down 9-2 in the seventh inning in a playoff game, you might not pull guys the same way that you would. The value is still there in chasing that 1%. You know, you might not go to your closer, you know, your fireman, your best relief pitcher in that situation, but the mop-up man isn't even on the roster at that point. You know, you might go to a long reliever of some kind, an additional starter, maybe to save guys' arms, but you don't have the chaff that is present during, you know, April through September. There's different roster construction. The rewards and risks are different. I don't have a problem with there being a couple extra off days. And, yeah, does that mean that bullpen guys are fresher? Sure, but don't we want to see the best players deciding games in October? Why is that a problem?
I don't think it is. At the same time, you couldn't use a bullpen the way that they are used in October, where you might go to Andrew Miller six times in seven games or something. If you did that, you kill him by the end of April. But you can push him harder in October and gain something of an advantage because, again, you don't have to show what got you there, be it the fourth reliever or the fifth starter, as you said. It's like a distorted picture. It's getting dressed up for photo day at high school. I don't know that it's wrong. It's just different.
Yeah, it that's all I'm saying. It's not wrong. It's different. And that's why, to me, the 162 is worth celebrating. You have gone through a gauntlet that is totally different than what you're going to face in October. Never mind October being, you know, a matchup of good teams in baseball, you know, a sport where you play seven games against a good team, losing four of them, even if you're the Dodgers could play the Phillies seven times and lose four of them. Like, if they played seven times in a week, going back and forth between, you know, they play the first three in LA and the next four in Philly, they could lose four. Would anybody be surprised by that if it happened just as good as this Dodgers team is? You know, they don't lose consecutive games ever. Ordinarily, like, you know, you take whoever the best team is in baseball and whoever the worst team is in baseball, would you be surprised if the worst team took 4 out of 7 from them? Yeah, but would you be shocked? No.
No, because there's enough random stuff, enough bad hops, enough bad calls by an umpire, enough, you know, I mean, the really famous one, again, I'm going to do Steve Scooby-Doo flashback here, but, you know, 1960 World Series, in the last game, if Tony Kubek doesn't get hit in the throat by a bad hop grounder, Bill Mazeroski doesn't get a chance to hit the home run.
Yeah, just go back to basketball. It's totally different. If the Knicks played the Warriors 7 times, you would expect the Knicks to lose all 7. Maybe they would get within single digits once. This is not that. This is a game where, we've touched on this before, where bad decisions can be rewarded. And, you know, you can make mistakes. You bring in the wrong pitcher, and the wrong pitcher still has, worst case, a 60% chance of getting a dude out. And so many things feed off of that and come off of that that you can just get away with stuff.
You can lead off Alcides Escobar, and he has a 4-for-4 that day.
You can have him swing at the first pitch of every game until somebody throws at his head in Game 3 of the World Series. And yeah, sure.
You know what relates to bad decisions being rewarded and fluke things that were happening right before we came on? I was looking at the video, and I don't know if you saw this, of the Rangers game on Sunday, where both the Rangers closer Matt Bush and the third baseman / first baseman Joey Gallo were injured on the same play. This ball that was hit between the pitcher's mound and short. And you know that pitchers are typically stay out of most defensive plays that aren't balls hit to the first baseman where they've got to cover first, or comebackers that are right to them. And why is that? People always congratulate pitchers like Greg Maddux, who won the Gold Glove every single year that he pitched, because he was an extra infielder. And I realized watching it, well, here's the reason why. And it was that as the ball went past and Matt Bush goes tearing out towards the shortstop position, Joey Gallo's coming in, and they clotheslined each other. And they're both on the DL now, where both Bush is, and I think Gallo is probably headed there with a nasal fracture. I've never seen that before in however many years of watching baseball. I don't think it's happened in the history of baseball that I can think of.
I can't remember anything like seeing that. And the thing that immediately made me wonder was Matt Bush's background as an infielder. And he was the number one overall draft pick as a shortstop before he converted to being a pitcher after, you know, all the trials and tribulations that he had on and off the field. I wonder how much just goes back to you go get the ball. How many times has he had to field a ball like that in his career as a pitcher? I wonder. It's not his background. And I wonder if that contributes to it as well.
When you said Bush and his, and you paused and said background, I was a little nervous because I have to admit, I shouldn't admit this. This is a terrible thing. But when I saw the collision, I saw him tearing out to short, there was a small, mean part of me that said, well, he's just a guy who doesn't have good judgment.
Will Jesse Spector save Stephen Goldman from saying something that could be construed as horribly unforgiving and judgmental? Come back after this break, and we'll find out.
Yeah. That's, I don't necessarily want to go there, but I don't blame you for doing it.
I was afraid you were going to go, and then I would have been in the position of saying, yeah, maybe we shouldn't, but now I feel dishonest not admitting that that thought didn't come to me, and I'm not saying it's a fair thought, and I'm not saying it's a right thought. It's the same way, I guess, and this is also dumb, but it's the same way when any player hits 3 home runs in a week or something, that somebody will now say they're juicing.
Yeah, I think when it comes to Matt Bush, that's something that's it's never out of your head, the car thing and the DUI, and you can't separate it. And that's something that I, you know, to bring it back to, you know, something just writerly, I'm never sure how to deal with that. Like, do you have to bring it up every single time? Or is it irresponsible if you don't? Like, if you don't mention it every single time? Or is there a point where it's like, this is part of the guy's story, it's not necessarily relevant to what we're talking about now and today, but it's there. How do you deal with that? I'm constantly flustered by it. Especially as we move into things like domestic violence and guys that have been suspended for it over time. And, you know, writing about Aroldis Chapman. Every time that I write that Aroldis Chapman isn't having a good time throwing strikes, or, you know, he's blowing a save, I can't bring up every single time.
Right.
Aroldis Chapman, who was suspended for the first month of the 2016 season, it just doesn't fit. But we all know it's there. And at the same time that you don't want to, you know, use word count on it in every story that the dude appears in. His full name isn't Aroldis Chapman, comma, who was suspended for the first month of 2016 for a domestic violence incident, comma. That's, you know, it's not relevant every single time, but at the same time you feel a sort of dereliction of duty for letting it slip. I don't know. I don't know how to deal with that as time goes on, because we shouldn't just forget about it, but at the same time, it's not relevant in every single time the dude is mentioned.
Well, let me posit a theory on that, because I was going to bring up a much more anodyne, harmless version of that, which is I confront the same thing with somebody like Ryan Braun. Ryan Braun is having a nice season for the Brewers, and the Brewers are in contention. To the extent that he's been healthy and played, he's been in 69 games. He's at .290, slugging .528. For a 33-year-old guy who's been hurt a lot,
it's not a nice bad season production.
And it's not what he was doing in his MVP years, but it's nice. And I have the same question. If I were to write, and Ryan Braun's been a contributor to the Brewers this year, do I have to throw that asterisk up there? And by the way, he had that whole long, drawn-out suspension thing and accusing the guy of mishandling the samples. And, you know, he's probably not the most honest guy in the world, but he's having a good season. And chances are he's clean, because everybody who's not clean does seem to get caught at this point. So let me make this suggestion. The reason that you and I have that feeling about Aroldis Chapman or Jose Reyes, I have the same instinct to do it with Jose Reyes and the increasingly infrequent times that he's relevant to the conversation, is because despite what baseball did, that is unresolved. It's not something that closes easily, because what they said was very vague and was very coached, because you can't know that it's really finished, because people who go down that road have a propensity to repeat. That's just a fact, the historical record of the way that domestic violence cases go. Whereas I feel like with Ryan Braun, he screwed up. He took his punishment. It doesn't necessarily mean that I have to feel great about him, but I'm kind of agnostic at best on steroids anyway. I don't think they really work the way that people think they work in terms of turning, you know, your average player into Superman. So I think it's kind of over anyway, regardless if it ever had really begun. And again, the testing regimen right now seems successful enough that it seems highly unlikely he would go back for seconds from that same dish. So there's something that you and I and a lot of other people are trying to resolve with those other guys, and it's not resolvable. If we could feel that it was somehow finished, like, just change the crime, change the punishment. Aroldis Chapman was arrested for shoplifting. Aroldis Chapman, I mean, you know, no one has any problem watching Winona Ryder in Stranger Things. She was arrested for shoplifting in a fairly strange moment, maybe 30 years ago at this point. I don't think people are sitting there going, shoplifter, as they're watching that. Are they?
I don't think so. But I think that it does change when it's not shoplifting. It's hitting somebody that you're in or an intimate relationship with, and then going off to your garage and firing a gun in anger and paying little to no consequence for it. I think that that is something where there does feel like there's more of a responsibility on us, as, you know, in the watchdog role of the press, to say, you remember, this guy never really had to pay for his crime in any way other than, you know, he lost a month's pay, for which he was then rewarded with a enormously fat contract at the end of the following season. He got traded to the eventual World Series winner and then got a giant contract and has never really been particularly remorseful in any notable way, which also is, in comparison to Reyes, also different, how he handled it. And, you know, I was there when Reyes went to Brooklyn for his first rehab game, you know, coming back with the Mets. Rehab seems a funny way to put it, but I guess that that's officially what it was.
Yeah.
But he took way more ownership of, you know, his responsibility in the situation. And certainly over the course of this year, what's been a very, very bad year for the Mets, Jose Reyes, while not good on the field, has been, I don't want to say he's been a model citizen, because I don't know that much and I don't know that deeply to be able to say it, but he is certainly somebody who has the respect of other players in that clubhouse, especially for the veteran know-how and wisdom that he has been able to impart into the younger players. He's a guy that, after some of their tougher and more embarrassing losses, he has been one of the guys who has stood up and showed his face and talked more honestly than a lot of other guys. That does not excuse, you know, allegedly putting his wife through a plate glass window in a hotel in Hawaii. That's not one. Yeah. One plus one is not adding up here. But he has, at least in a way that Chapman has not, clearly made attempts to be a better human being. And I think that means something, and I don't know. I don't know how to sort these things out. There's no real guide for it, because there are people who will say, no, that guy is forever. And I can't disagree with that. Like,
no, I feel that way too.
But he's still there, and we still have to find a way to refer to these people somehow.
We as professionals have an obligation to just say what's happening, right?
Yeah.
As fans, it's very frustrating, because if we chose, for example, like, we don't want to see another Mel Gibson movie, doesn't matter how good people say it is or who else is in it, just don't want to give that guy my money. We have that choice. But in the case of Aroldis Chapman, if you're in, say, the New York market, or you're a Yankees fan, Hal Steinbrenner made that choice for you and forced that down your throat. And like you said, rewarded this guy with a massive contract. And for that matter, the Cubs were purely hypocritical about emphasizing character for their organization and then bending over backwards to forgive this guy, to exculpate him to a degree that he had not earned. And he paid them back by throwing them under the bus when he left, complaining about the way he was handled. Which, by the way, came to mind the other day, because when Joe Girardi pulled Chapman out of the closer's role, Chapman said, I'll do whatever it takes to help the team. I'm perfectly happy to do whatever until I get better. And I thought, you know, as soon as he's back on top, it'll be the same thing. He'll be saying that Joe Girardi didn't handle him correctly, because that's apparently his nature. You and I are not necessarily who, what, where, when, why, how beat guys, where we have to give the raw facts of the game. We're more often pundits and people who can make a comment about things. So I don't know if we have the obligation to play it down the middle. I think we can call it as we see it. And this is not somebody, to me, who it's worth having on a team, because the associations are just unpleasant. This is an entertainment at the end of it.
I don't know where the line is. I just don't. Because I think there's also a point, and this comes from reading some writers, you know, certainly during my time as a copy editor, there were some columnists who I didn't necessarily always agree with. And sometimes I found that as a columnist, you do run the risk of having favorite targets that you pick at. And at that point, it almost turns a little bit to a feeling like, even though they're lousy as human beings, it can feel like you are picking on them unfairly, because you're going after them at moments where it is not necessarily opportune to do so. And I'm wary of that. And again, is it ever wrong to point out that Aroldis Chapman is, by most accounts, a lousy dude and a guy who, like you said, treats his managers for not owning up to his own performance in addition to everything with the domestic violence? No, you're never wrong to point that out. But if you point it out every single time, do you run the risk of turning him sympathetic because you are the evil news media guy? Not fake news, but that's, you know, certainly the climate that we live in is one of people having this idea that so much of the media is fake and dishonest, and that we are out to get subject A and subject B. It exists outside of sports and is prevalent outside of sports for sure, but it also does exist in sports where there are favorite targets that people have, and that it is a real thing, but it's also a perceived thing at times. You know, I know that there are Blue Jays fans out there who, because I have been critical of the Blue Jays over time for various player transactions and front office moves, that think, I just cannot stand the Blue Jays. I don't like them. I have it out for the Toronto Blue Jays. And those people could not be more incorrect. Dozens, if not more, Blue Jays fans who think that I have it in for them because I have been critical on points of opinion. The one that goes back, you know, forever, and that I think that Blue Jays fans really think that I have it in for them, is something that wasn't even necessarily about the Blue Jays, outside of the fact that Josh Donaldson got traded there. I wrote a thing about how the A's were not wrong to make that trade, and how they could wind up winning that trade in years to come. I don't think that that is necessarily panning out, just on the basis of things did not go as planned for Brett Laurie, that is for sure, and then some of the other prospects that they've gotten. A lot of my take there now hinges on Franklin Barreto, But the idea of winning a trade does not necessarily mean that your favorite team, the other team in the trade, lost the trade. And in fact, in most situations, it is possible for both teams to win a trade, except if you're the Mets and you are trading all of your good players for cash considerations, and in some case trading player and cash for cash considerations, as they did with Curtis Granderson, which is, boy, this is not a good time to be a Mets fan.
I mean, they can take that to any cheesecake factory in the country for a slice of free cheesecake, and I think that that's a hard deal to pass up, particularly if your name is Wilpon.
I can't believe they're continued to be allowed to run this team as a second-class operation as they do. And now the news that came out today of Steven Matz may need to have surgery. how have they had the same trainer all these years? And Ray Ramirez will be right back out there opening day 2018 getting booed by a full house at Citi Field, and that'll be that. 15 more guys will get mysteriously injured for no good reason whatsoever. Nothing
You know, Jesse, you don't disappoint me, because I made a little vow to myself that whereas I knew the Mets would come up, I was going to wait till the very last to bring them up if they hadn't come up otherwise. And the Steven Matz story, which broke right before we got together here, is certainly relevant to talk about. But we always get so sidetracked on the Mets because they're such a wonderful story that...
You go through enough disillusionment over the course of 47 minutes and you're going to land on the Mets at some point. I mean, we did talk about Jose Reyes, so that kind of counts.
Do I bring this out in you, or is it just the kind of the zeitgeist of the times? Because it's probably a little of both, I would think.
I live in New York. They're a good outlet for just emotional angst. My kids wind up saying funny and silly things about them on a regular basis. Like, and my daughter just going like, oh, the Mets are my favorite team. They lose, like, every game. And it's just like, yeah, well, yeah, they do. They lose a lot.
I struggle with part of what you just said, because I was writing about the Cincinnati Reds earlier today, and the entire Reds pitching staff broke in some way, including two of their three best pitchers from last year, and they only had three, basically, which is why their starting rotation has an ERA of 6-something right now, which puts them among the worst teams of this century in terms of starting rotations. And I don't know how to evaluate how much of that is just pitchers go twang. And sometimes you have a cluster of pitchers go twang, just like you might have a cancer cluster. And cancer clusters are very hard to prove, because people get cancer in general. And if you have five people in a room who got it, was it that there was dioxin in the room, or was it that they all just happened to have some genetic predisposition to that? A similar thing with the pitcher. The thing with the Mets, I know there are some teams that are better than others at keeping pitchers healthy, but at the same time, I don't know if that's just kind of the opposite of a cancer cluster. It's a healthy cluster, and we're just looking at random patterns of people being healthy and being injured and inflicting or imposing meaning on them without really understanding.
I think at some point your position players have to act as your control group in a way, and the way that they're handled. And the Mets have demonstrably, over a long period of time, shown a great degree of incompetence for dealing with the health of the human beings who play for the New York Mets. It's not a new thing. And they let guys play through things. They go back to Cespedes earlier this year and what they tried with him, and then, you know, he comes back before he's really ready, and then he tweaks it, he makes it worse, and that helps to submarine their whole season. There's only so many times that you can have, like, everybody on your team get hurt before you say, this is more than just flat bad luck. You know, this is a pattern, and it's something that doesn't happen to other teams. And gosh, yeah, some of it is terrible luck, but some of it is we're letting guys play through things. And I don't know, does it go at all to Terry Collins being an old school guy who maybe players are a little bit more apt to say, you know, I want to impress him and I want to try to play through this? Or is there something else going on in their training regimen? I don't know. I don't have those answers. But it is clear that, you know, for whatever reason, the Mets deal with this kind of thing year after year after year. And, you know, you can even go back to Matt Harvey and the innings limit. And beyond that, like, him trying to push his way back to pitch at the end of the 2014 season, and they rightfully did not allow that to happen, but there was serious consideration seemingly given to it as a possibility if he could have gotten back healthy enough to try to do it. And it's bonkers. It's just, they go through the same thing and change nothing other than maybe they tell the manager that he's not allowed to talk about injuries anymore publicly.
That's the part that got to me, is after all this stuff that we've been through, the announcement was that Steven Matz is heading for the disabled list with an undisclosed injury, a secret injury, an injury too mysterious for us to talk about, in part because we hadn't actually communicated it to Sandy Alderson, or maybe Terry Collins, or maybe Matz himself, who knows. It's a very strange way to go about things, that somehow you publicize this thing, then internally disseminate the idea that you're going to do it.
They're an upside-down cake of an organization in a lot of ways. And now I just want cake. Why did I say cake?
Because that Granderson coupon is good for upside-down cake at any Cheesecake Factory location in the tri-state area.
Do we have Cheesecake Factories in the tri-state area?
We do, yeah, sure, near me. Come across the river sometime, and I'll treat you to a Cheesecake Factory 2,000-calorie salad followed by 5,000-calorie cheesecake, and we'll all roll home.
Here I am just excited because I know that the last time that I drove to Newark, there was a Wawa up off of I-280, and now I know that, like, when I go to these Devils games, I can stop at Wawa on the way home and stock up on that iced tea.
There is a Wawa almost literally across the street from my house, and I'm probably in there, if not every day, then every other day. And there was a storm recently that knocked the roof off of that Wawa, and now they are closed for remodeling for a month. Oof. And I am just at loose ends.
Yeah.
Other than the totally laughable name, which I still marvel over that there is a business that sounds like a Gilda Radner impression from 1976.
That is a deep cut. As far as I'm concerned, it's a deep cut in my cultural knowledge. Maybe because I'm like 8 years too young for it. I don't know. But it's the name of a town. It's Wawa, Pennsylvania is what it's named for.
Yes, but for a long time I didn't know that. So the first time I ever saw one, and they were in deep South Jersey before I ever saw them in my part of New Jersey, which is more central New Jersey. So the first time I was probably about 15, and I just see this sign coming up the road that says Wawa. And it just struck me as hilarious. And by the way, Gilda Radner's on my mind today because you might have seen me tweet this. I was going through some old newspapers looking for something for this podcast, actually, not for this part of the discussion, which I didn't find. But I came across an ad from a South Carolina paper in 1975 for a movie called The Four of Us. It was for a movie playing at a drive-in, and it was, if not porn, then an erotic film. IMDb doesn't have a lot of information on it except to say that it is a film about bisexual wife swapping. I grew up near a drive-in movie theater, literally behind one, to the extent that I could peek out my window and see the movie and hear the dialogue in the air. And the idea that you would have an adult film playing at a drive-in where anybody could just kind of pass by and see it blows my mind. But I remembered a Saturday Night Live routine where Gilda Radner talked about that and how large the body parts were. And the phrase rectal eclipse was something that she said.
Hello.
Yeah, those two words have never left my mind. Ironically, today, the day that we're talking, was the day of basically what was the national eclipse.
Yeah.
That was a different kind of eclipse that she was talking about. But it almost tarnishes a childhood memory of mine, because there was something magical about living near the drive-in theater and having all these voices come out of the speakers, even if you were a few football fields away, which I basically was.
I've never experienced a drive-in movie theater. I'm fascinated by the concept. My entire knowledge of it is basically off of an episode of Cheers, where they all go to the drive-in, and I think it's a good episode. I found that I've been thinking about Cheers a lot more lately for some reason, and I don't know necessarily why that is.
You can correct me on this maybe, but I struggled with Cheers at the time when it was in its first run. The problem for me with it was that every character was so eccentric, or so much the qualities that of that character's quirks, that I didn't really have a point of view character to glom onto. I didn't necessarily identify with Sam, who wasn't the smartest guy in the world, and I never understood why he was so attracted to Diane, who was kind of obnoxious, and like everybody was funny in their own way, but there was no calm center to the storm.
Those first few seasons don't even really click for me quite as much, and I know that, you know, I'm definitely in the minority on that overall as far as Cheers goes. I can see myself getting a quizzical look from my wife as I say that, but that is that is the way that it is for me. My preference just naturally gravitates to what I saw first and what I watched fresh as it came, which was those last few seasons, and in particular the final season really connected for me. And I still remember the very best part of breaking my elbow in Little League was that when I went to the emergency room and had a very long wait, it was the night that they were rerunning the full series finale of Cheers, and they had it on in the waiting room at the ER. So I got to watch it all over again.
So wait, how old were you when you broke your elbow?
I want to say 11.
Okay, you were younger. I also suffered a broken bone playing baseball, a broken hand, but I was older. I was 15 or 16.
Yeah, I broke my elbow on I guess the opposite of the Cliff Floyd play. I was trying to beat out an infield hit. The first baseman was the one who made the error in this case of had his foot like all the way across the first base bag. And I still remember, more than I remember the contact with the ground, I remember the contact of my ankle and his ankle and me. I can still just feel myself floating in the air on my way to the ground, and then the screaming. There was a lot of screaming.
Since I was older, I didn't lose it that way. I went into shock, actually. I was in high school. It was a grounder to the infield, and I was playing first base because you've met me, so you know I'm strictly catcher, first base, right field, DH material. The throw from the infielder tailed into the runner, so I caught the ball, didn't have time to get my hand out of the way of the incoming runner. Mm-hmm. He hit my hand stayed, my thumb kept going.
That's the Cliff Floyd play. Why, he was an outfielder.
Right. You're right. I'd forgotten. I went up to my best friend and, you know, my thumb is at this strange angle to my hand. And I said, I think I've broken my thumb. And he said, oh, that's nice. And went off to class. And I went up to my girlfriend and said, look, my thumb is broken. And she said, oh, that's neat, Steve. And just kind of walked away. And I went for quite a while with it before I eventually found my way to the nurse and got released. And that was more or less almost the end of my playing days.
Was it? I don't want to ask you to describe like what angle it was bent at. There's no good answers there.
I'll give you two words: unnatural hitchhike.
Yeah. Okay.
And whether you want to take unnatural hitchhike and pair it with rectal eclipse, that's up to you.
I wasn't going to, but now it seems unavoidable, and I wish to erase that from my memory. Now I have to live with this forever. Unnatural hitchhike, rectal eclipse. That's
One last baseball question before we wrap up here. I don't know if we've had any baseball questions today. I think we have.
We've talked about baseball.
We have. We both agree that we can sing He's a Jolly Good Fellow whenever Aroldis Chapman comes in from the bullpen, and that we're going to have to leave that issue open because, honestly, I don't feel smart enough to know the answer to that one because I struggle with it myself. It's difficult. To get back to it for one second, the thing that kept coming to my mind is, as a writer, it's not just about being fair or unfair to the player. I also don't want to be a bore to the audience. And it seems to me that you deploy it as necessary. And if he pitches a 1-2-3 inning in the ninth, not that that happens anymore, then you just say he pitched a 1-2-3 inning in the ninth and you get the hell out of the way. If somebody is debating his value to the team, his value as a character, whether he should be traded or signed or released or given a trip to Europe, then maybe it's relevant to bring up the other stuff.
I think that's reasonable. And I think that's generally how we do approach it. You develop a natural feeling on when it's right, when it's not, but I worry about whether that means that I'm personally getting it correct. I don't know. That's the open question.
And again, we can keep going in circles because you don't want to normalize it or give the guy a subtle pass, essentially. You don't want to, by not commenting, let it be forgot because, again, this is not somebody who you want to be part of what is entertainment.
The tough analog on this is Bartolo. Because he was suspended, did have the whole second family thing going on. But we don't talk about any of the negatives really so much with Bartolo Colon because he's America's pudgy uncle who still gets to pitch when he's in his mid-40s. And we all love him and don't want to see bad things happen to him. He's our teddy bear. Is that fair and appropriate? Probably not when you really think about it. No, that he gets a free pass on stuff that other guys wouldn't. Why? Because he's older and tubby?
No, there's a double standard, but then there's probably a double standard about infliction of emotional harm and infliction of physical harm. That's also a very hard thing to navigate.
Oh, yeah, but I'm saying with Ryan Braun, it still gets brought up about the steroid stuff. Cologne was in that same whole Biogenesis deal. It is 50.
The HGH or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so you have off-the-field stuff combined with drug stuff, and nobody talks about, and I'm not really eager to talk about it, but it's there, and it's brushed away with him in a way that it really isn't for other dudes.
Here's my question, because I'm not as conversant with this. Was it consensual or clandestine when he was doing that? Because I think back to something like the famous or infamous Fritz Peterson Mike Kekich thing, excuse me, where they were with the Yankees and they got close and they decided to swap wives and swap dogs and swap families, and it worked out very well for one of them and it was kind of disastrous for the other, and it was this cause celeb in the media. People were appalled or titillated or something, and really it seems like it was never any of anybody's business. Why it became public that way, I don't know, but it did. If someone is leading a unconventional, let's say, polyamorous life where everybody knows what's going on and everybody involved is aware and comfortable, then I don't feel like we have a right to make a comment. If it's, again, clandestine and you're a closeted bigamist, that's a whole other thing.
Here's the story, and this is a New York Post story from last year. Headline, Bartolo Colon's double life with secret family. Mets pitcher Bartolo Colon has been living a double life that gives new meaning to his nickname, Big Sexy, siring two secret love children with a woman while married to his devoted wife of 21 years, the Post has learned. The 42-year-old hurler has been dragged into Manhattan court by Alexandra Santos, 38, who claims the $7 million a year player is a deadbeat dad who failed to pay child support for their elementary school age kids. Colon, who has earned more than $100 million in his career, sired the children with the Washington Heights woman while he was also playing the dutiful family man with wife Rosanna and their four sons. I don't like the fact that they used sire in three paragraphs.
That's a term for horse racing.
Yeah.
The judgment in that story.
They reached a child support deal last June, according to the New York Daily News story here. Mets Bartolo Colon and his baby mama reached deal in child support battle.
But see, that's very pejorative, and what you don't know is what his wife's knowledge or perspective was. And I'm not trying to excuse him. I'm not trying to whitewash the story because I'm this huge Bartolo fan. I'm not. I just think life is very complex. Relationships are very complex. I've had the occasion in my life to observe, not exactly what he's doing, but many situations that are non-traditional in one way or the other. And I've learned that the expectations that I was raised with are not necessarily the same for everyone. And they're not good or bad, provided that, again, there's honesty with everybody.
I think that when you get into lawsuits and that kind of thing being file, that suggests that there's something that's less than amicable about the whole setup.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that he may not have done what was right to do by the third party, the paramour or whatever.
Sure. But if his wife was on board with whatever it was that he was doing, that is none of our business.
Right. So, I mean, again, like, I would judge a deadbeat dad. Absolutely. I think you have certain obligations and you should fulfill them. But all right. So one last baseball thing I was curious about, and this also is both a New York and Miami story. Now, the Jeff Loria administration was finally coming to an end, and Derek Jeter and a group he is involved with is purchasing the Marlins. Supposedly Jeter will be the front man in terms of baseball operations. And a lot of people, because there is still a cult of Jeter, were very excited by that, both because Loria's ownership has been deplorable. That's a loaded term to use, isn't it? It has other...
Loria was talked about as a possible ambassador in this administration, so I'm fine with it.
Fair enough. His administration has been deplorable. And Jeter, because he's a proven winner and a true Yankee and all that stuff, everybody felt or seemed to feel like this meant salvation for the franchise. And I thought back and thought, how many guys have really gone more or less directly from the playing field to running a baseball team without having some kind of administrative experience in between? And there's not a lot. There are guys like Hank Greenberg and Charlie Gehringer going way back. It hasn't happened a lot in recent years. Even, and this is not a positive example exactly, Ruben Amaro Jr. had many years as an AGM before getting to the big chair with the Phillies after Pat Gillick retired. What do we really know about what Derek Jeter is going to do? Does it mean that the Marlins are necessarily saved?
No. We know nothing. We know that he's a smiling, happy face on the whole thing, and that there continue to be reports that the money's not all there, which is par for the course with anything like this. I don't know. I look at it like Magic Johnson at least had a record of entrepreneurship and, you know, the Magic Johnson theaters and everything else that he's done. before he got into things with the Dodgers. I think that Jeter kind of styles himself as the Michael Jordan of his set.
He wasn't.
No, of course he wasn't. But as far as iconography and hagiography, he certainly is. I think that he's trying to follow in that sort of mold of doing the things that Michael Jordan has done. And that hasn't really been a sparkling success there in Charlotte. So I don't know exactly what we're getting into. And it might be a thing that Jeter comes to regret later on, but probably not, because down the road he's gonna be even wealthier than he was before, and that's what winds up being important in this, because it's not ultimately, like, if they win, great, it looks great on him. If they aren't winners there with him as the CEO, front man, whatever, well, there's 30 teams in the league, and it's hard to do. And Miami has its own challenges and issues, and the fact that Derek Jeter is the CEO of a baseball team is not going to suddenly start putting butts in the seats at Marlins Park. Like, that's nobody's coming to watch the CEO executive, chiefly, in an efficient way. That's not how it works. So
right, it's like the Dodgers making Babe Ruth first base coach in 1938. I mean, it didn't change anything insofar as the team went. It just meant they had a slightly larger crowd for batting practice.
It's entirely upside on Jeter's part. Nobody ever, I shouldn't say nobody, I'm sure somebody somewhere has lost money. The Wilpons have lost money running a...
It all comes back to the world.
But seriously, that's the example of how pathetic, like, to financially ruin yourself as a Major League Baseball team owner, you have to be like Tom Hicks or the Wilpons and get into some just off-board, insane garbage that you should have been able to see through if you had any kind of business competence whatsoever.
And you left out the key part. Not in Tampa, not in Miami, not in Oakland, in New York.
Put Tom Hicks in there, too. I guess, you know, Frank McCourt, yeah, don't get into an insane divorce either. So I guess that's something that's there for Jeter. But, you know, he and his wife just had their first baby, so congratulations to them.
Congratulations to them. And I do think he's intelligent because supposedly he has not put a huge chunk of money into this.
No.
Why should he? Because
he's the face.
Right. And his face is whatever other qualities he may or may not possess vis-a-vis his Michael Jordan-ness. He does legitimate that group.
Yeah, and he certainly, if things are going well, sure, he can probably buy in more as time goes on and make himself more money. He's going to be fabulously wealthy, and more power to him for that. Wonderful. I'm happy for him that he has been able to turn a legitimate Hall of Fame baseball career, he is that, into status as, it's really tough, but he's managed to make himself overrated as a Hall of Famer over time. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with the way that he carried himself and the way that he conducted business throughout his career. And it's worked. So bless him. You know, he's on to the next, and it'll be bigger and better. And he will be successful in it. And whether that means the Marlins are successful is neither really here nor there, because it never really is with ownership.
One last note on that, and you'll appreciate this as a writer guy, even if it is slightly pedantic. You will recall that during his playing career, he had a long-term shilling for some car company or another. I forget which.
Ford. The Ford Edge. Jeter's got an edge.
Right, there you go. And there was a long-running commercial where he said, I've got a new website with Ford Edge.
Mm-hmm. Check out my website.
Yeah, but this is how he said it. He said, you should really check it out. And it used to bother me, because it should be, you really should check it out. Not, you should really check it out, which implies some kind of deep investigation, maybe with a tongue depressor or even a more invasive tool. I'm not sure.
Oh, well, we'll need the attorneys general of many states to look into where this is going.
And deeply invasive tools brings us back to rectal eclipse. And on that note...
There you go. Okay.
Jesse, as always, it's been...
You've said it three times. That means it happens.
I just want to make sure that we've, pardon the expression, really driven that one home.
Is that the title of this episode?
Roll credits. Once again, Jesse, thank you for dropping by. It's been an entertaining and edifying experience, as always.
And Sam Miller, if you've stuck around, I told
you. We're sorry, Sam.
I told you no.
By Neptune's beard, we've reached the end of another episode, just barely intact. You can follow Jesse on Twitter at Jesse Spector, the classic formulation, and you can follow me at Go Steven Goldman. Why Go Steven Goldman? Because Gopher Steven Goldman is my Zootopia character and has been trademarked by Disney. You can also write us at infiniteinning@gmail.com, and please, please, please rate us at iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. It does make a difference. We have sponsorship now, but this episode is still brought to you by the number 23. A different number 23 than the last time I mentioned number 23. You'll figure it out. My producer is so ridiculously indolent. Well, let's just say that this past weekend, somebody mistook him for a Civil War statue and put him in storage. Our theme song, which you have heard throughout the episode, and in fact are listening to now, was co-written by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. Once when we were about 12, we were walking through the woods, saw a glowing orange light about 3 feet off the ground, and felt certain we were being stalked by a cigarette-smoking midget. There's a more reasonable explanation for it, but I'm still not convinced. Well, assuming I don't fail to convince the Science Council that this planet is about to explode and needs to be evacuated, I'll be back next week with Meg Rowley, and we'll have more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.